Right, sorry about that, everyone. I just had to make sure the lectern was behaving because I've got to read quite a bit this evening. So, tonight we are starting on another chapter of King's Cross. We're very close to the end now. As I know most of you will have been following this, I don't need to go through the book again, but we are on part two, the cross, and we have just come to the end of a very unusual Passover. As those of you who were here last week will know, Jesus finished the Passover pretty abruptly and pretty early. It was a normal Passover until he started doing strange things with the rituals. He washed his disciples' feet when they were meant to have washed their hands, and he took the matzah, that's the unleavened bread, and the cup of wine, passed it around and said, "Drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is given for you and for many. Do this in remembrance of me." And then, rather abruptly, he leaves the Passover. That's it. It's over. Maybe what brought on Jesus' very unusual behavior in the Garden of Gethsemane in this chapter was the fact that the next cup, the cup he didn't drink, was the cup of wrath. The cup of wrath is the fourth cup in the Passover, and the Jews would pour out the cup, you open the door, you say, "Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who created the fruit of the vine." And once the door is opened, you say this prayer. I've only got part of it here because it's very, very long. "Pour out your wrath upon the nations that do not acknowledge you, and upon the kingdoms that do not call upon your name. For they have devoured Jacob and laid waste his habitation. Pour out your indignation upon them, and let the wrath of your anger overwhelm them. Pursue them with anger and destroy them from beneath the heavens of the Lord. Hallel, not to us, Lord, not to us, but to your name give glory for the sake of your kindness and for your truth." Now, that's not the sort of prayer we're used to. It's certainly not the sort of prayer that are said in churches. And if churches do make comments like that, people tend to think, "Oh, not too sure about this teaching. That sounds a bit fundamentalist to me." So let's ask ourselves a question. What does he mean by the cup of wrath? Is that something biblical, or is that something traditional the rabbis have just come up with? Well, actually, yes. The cup of wrath is in the Bible. When I was looking up where it might have come from, I discovered that the cup of wrath is used as a metaphor in a couple of biblical chapters where it's particularly obvious. This is Isaiah 51, verses 21 to 23. "Therefore, hear, you afflicted one, made drunk, but not with wine. This is what the sovereign Lord says, your God who defends his people. See, I have taken out of your hands the cup of that made you stagger. From that cup, the goblet of my wrath, you will never drink again. I will put it into the hands of your tormentors, who said to you, 'Fall prostrate that we may walk over you.' And you made your back like the ground, like a street to be walked over." In other words, afflicted one, that's Israel, I'm not going to give you the cup of wrath again. I'm going to make your tormentors drink it. I'm going to make the people who are pushing you around drink it. Then in Jeremiah chapter 25, verses 15 to 25, I'm going to stop at verse 20, says, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, said to me. Take from my hand this cup filled with the wine of my wrath, and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it. When they drink it, they will stagger and go mad because of the sword I will send among them." So I took the cup from the Lord's hand and made all the nations to whom he sent me drink it. Jerusalem and the towns of Judah, its kings and its officials to make them a ruin and an object of horror and scorn and cursing as they are today. Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, his attendants, his officials, and all his people, and all the foreign people there, all the kings of Uz, all the kings of the Philistines, to those of Ashkelon, Gaza, Ekron, and the people left at Amshod. Now, if any of you want to carry on reading, you will find that the next bit is a long list of all the kings that the people would have heard about. The king of Arabia, the king of the Philistines, and all the others. Why on earth is that there? It's there because God is saying, I've punished Israel. They're in exile in Babylon. Now I'm going to make the rest of the nations pay for what they've done. I'm not going to let them off. I may have said Nebuchadnezzar was my servant, but I'm not going to just sit back and say, oh, well, that was what I wanted him to do, so we have no problem here. We have no quarrel. I'm going to punish them as well. This isn't a part of God that people like hearing about. People say, I don't want an angry God. I want a loving God. But actually, what they often mean by that is, I want a God who doesn't make my life difficult. I want a God who loves me. And by love, I mean I want a God who does allow me to do whatever I want. How many of you parents have had children who, when you have told them not to do something, or that they can't watch that film because it's an 18, have said, but you said you loved me. You've all heard it. And what they actually mean is, if you loved me, you would let me do what I want. Because surely if you love me, you don't want me to be upset. All children know how to do the guilt trick in order to try to make parents do what they want. Let you in on a secret. I know how the guilt trick works. I'm pretty sure I did it quite a lot when I was a kid. Everyone knows how the guilt trick works. It's what you use when you're having an argument with your spouse, I assume. I'm not married. It's what you use when you're talking to a friend who is trying to explain to you the course of life you have just set your heart on isn't working and it's only making things worse. You get cross when you see people doing stupid things which you know are self-destructive. If you don't get cross when you see your children doing things which you know are destructive and you know are a bad idea, do you really love them that much? Surely you would tell your child off if you found him playing with a carving knife. And the fact that he thought it was his toy and he wanted to play with it makes no difference. You are not going to let him play with that thing. He'll cut himself. And the fact that he may yell at you for taking it away from him, or she might yell at you for taking it away from her, makes no difference. Very often in society today, people are told, well, you can't actually tell your child they're being naughty. You can't tell them what they're doing is wrong, because that's negative. That's not nice. No. It isn't, but it's loving. In a play I'm working on at the moment, one of my main characters gets very upset when his friend explains to him that what he is doing is damaging his marriage. And he says, but I thought you were my friend. How can you be so rotten to me? And she says, look, I love you. I love you both, you and your wife, very much. That is why I am telling you that what you are doing is going to flush your marriage down the U-bend. That's more important than being nice to you. Do we really want a God of love? Or do we want a nice God? Some people have tried to cope with this by saying that the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament are different. What they say is, it's like the good cop and bad cop scenario. Any of you who have watched crime dramas will have seen this at one point or another. Just imagine you've got a suspect sitting across from the interrogation table. Let's say this is the interrogation table. I'm the suspect. You've got good cop over there on the left, for the benefit of the recording, and bad cop on the right. They're both sitting opposite me, and good cop is saying, look, you've got yourself into real trouble here. I want to help you. I don't want to see you in prison. I want to see you free. I want to see you back with your family tonight. But I cannot do that if you won't talk to me. So come on, tell me what it is you need to tell us. Let me deal with it. Bad cop goes, you stupid piece of filth. When the judge gets his hands on you, you're going down for life, and it's all your fault. So tell us now, and we'll make it easier for you. They both care about justice. They're probably both good people. It's a game they're playing to persuade the suspect to talk. People think God's like that. They say, well, you see, they both really care about you, but the God of the Old Testament is bad cop. All he is doing is showing the judgmental side of God and the angry side of God and the Puritan side of God, for want of a better word, which cannot stand sin. And Jesus is the good cop. He's the one who wants to help you. It's neat and tidy, but it's completely and utterly wrong. To illustrate my point, let's go on to another piece from the Bible. The book of Judges, chapter 10, verses 6 to 16. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They served the Baals of the Amorites, weird words they have here, and the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the Ammonites, and the gods of the Philistines. And because the Israelites forsook the Lord and no longer served him, he became angry with them. He gave them into the hands of the Philistines and the Ammonites, who that year shattered and crushed them. For 18 years they oppressed all the Israelites on the east side of the Jordan, in Gilead, and the land of the Amorites. The Ammonites also crossed the Jordan to fight against Judah, Benjamin, and the house of Ephraim, and Israel was in great distress. Then the Israelites cried out to the Lord, we have sinned against you, forsaken our God, and served the Baals. The Lord replied, look, when the Egyptians, the Amorites, the Ammonites, the Philistines, the Sidonites, the Amalekites, and the Maonites oppressed you, and you cried out to me for help, did I not rescue you? Did I not take them out of your hands? But you have forsaken me and served other gods. So I will no longer save you. Go and cry out to the gods you have chosen. Let them save you when you are in trouble. But the Israelites said to the Lord, we have sinned. Do to us whatever you think best, but please rescue us now. Then they got rid of the foreign gods among them and served the Lord, and he could bear Israel's misery no longer. God's response, I know there are a lot of different ites there, and it's very easy to mix them up. I'm pretty sure I just did that. God's response was, I've rescued you time and time again, and you've ignored me. So from now on, I'm not going to bother. Go to those gods who you're looking after, who are serving you, you're serving now. They can help you. You obviously don't want me anymore. It's the sort of response you will see in soap operas from a spouse or a partner who has been cheated on. And it's a common response too. You're obviously not interested in me. You cheated on me. Go back to her. Go back to him. Don't you come banging on my door. Why should I care about you? You obviously don't care about me. The Israelites had to do more than say they were sorry. They had to show they meant it. But the God we worshipped accepted them when they got rid of the foreign gods and he gave them a judge to rescue them. You can read the story in Judges 11. The judge was flawed, but he saved Israel. And you can read that and go, but for heaven's sake, you know they're going to do it again. They're not serious. As soon as you've rescued them, they'll go straight back to those gods they were worshipping before you. All of them. And God knew they would. But he could not stand and watch Israel suffer anymore. You see, the other wonderful thing about having a God who can be angry at the way you behave is that he's capable of forgiving. So now we've understood what God's wrath is, that the cup of wrath is about God's anger. Let's go back to Gethsemane, where Jesus is terrified. He's bowed down on the ground and is saying, Father, if it's possible, take your anger away from me. I can't stand this idea of looking at you and only seeing anger. I don't want to take on your anger. I want the people saved, but surely there's another way. As Saji said this morning, and Tim Keller says in his book, you never see Jesus this vulnerable before. He was so terrified of what was about to happen that it says sweat ran down his forehead and onto the ground like drops of blood. And when an angel came down from heaven and strengthened him, that just made it worse. In Luke, it says an angel appeared to him and strengthened him, and being in great anguish, he prayed more earnestly. So in other words, God stiffened his resolve, and he still prayed, Father, take this cup from me, if it's possible to take it from me. Here in the church, we're fond of celebrity. It's not actually new for us to want to idolize people who we think are great. That's happened right from the dawn of time. If you look at the histories of the church, you will find the martyrs and the saints are held in very high regard. Tim Keller himself talks about the burning of Ridley and another Protestant martyr. And before his burning, Ridley was told, be of good cheer, Master Ridley, and play the man. We shall this day light such a candle in England by God's good grace that I trust will never be put out. And you read that and think, that is so unfair. Well, I do anyway. I think that's so unfair. How can these people go to their deaths willingly, and all I've got is a hearing problem that's not been healed yet and maybe getting worse, a sight problem that won't go away, and I'm still finding it hard. Well, how do we know they didn't have their own dark night of the soul locked up in their cells before Hugh Latimer and Nicholas Ridley were burnt? We don't. They could well have done. And I believe they probably did. You see, when you look at Jesus, if you only had the story of his trial, where he stood up to Pontius Pilate, he stood up to the Pharisees, you would not know he'd had his dark night of the soul where he begged God for another way. That bit's there for a reason. It's there to tell us whatever happens, God can understand how we feel. If you have a dark night of the soul, God will be with you and can walk you through it, because he had one himself. He was so loving, he was willing to bear the Father's anger. God was willing to be separated from God so that we don't have to be separated from God. Tim Keller is absolutely right. What Jesus experienced in the Garden of Gethsemane is something we will never have to experience, because God will never leave us. When you're depressed, God's still there. When you're sick, God's still there, even if it feels as though he isn't. If God is upset with us, and we cry out to him, he knows we're fallible. He knows we'll break his rules again. He knows we'll sin again, but he can't stand and watch us in misery, which is why he did what he did. Tonight's a healing service, as well as communion, which means that here we can be prayed for healing. I've always found those services really difficult, because every time I've gone to them, I've heard encouraging messages about people who've been healed, and nothing seems to have changed. I've had to sit amongst crowds of people where lots of people are prayed for, no one's come to pray for me, and even when they do, I'm still stuck with my problems. And I think to myself sometimes, that is so unfair. Part of me doesn't even want to hear messages from people that God will heal me, because I've heard it so often now, it just feels like old news. But we need to remember, the God we worship is a healer with wounds. The God we worship, the greatest healer of the world, was crucified. He wasn't a great person in the world sense. He wasn't someone who had all the answers and all the cures, and all you had to do was go to him and he would heal you. He offers us his presence, so that when we go through the valley of the shadow and we feel we're going through the dark night of the soul, he can take our hands and lead us through it into the sunshine. Even if we can't see the sunshine at the moment, God can. So if you come here tonight for healing, I'm not going to pray that God will give you what you want, but that he will give you what you need. For some of us, that's physical healing. For some of us, it's a reminder of his presence. Maybe for some of you, you don't know this God who I'm talking about. You have never experienced his love before. It's right here. He loves you enough to get angry when you go the wrong way, like any parent would. And more importantly, he loves you enough to forgive you when you come to him with an open heart. God bless you all. Thank you.